Welcome to In Conversation with Lyndon Terracini, the podcast where we meet the extraordinary talents, both on stage and off, working at Opera Australia. These conversations were all originally filmed for our streaming service, OA TV. You can find more online at tv.opera.org.au, as well as full productions and behind-the-scenes footage. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to OA TV, and my very, very special guest today, the wonderful director Gail Edwards. Gail has had an incredible career all over the world, from Shakespeare to musicals to opera to everything, really. So, Gail, it's great to see you.
Thanks, Lyndon. Thanks for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. It's wonderful to have you back here in this rehearsal room.
A rehearsal room I've worked in many times.
Exactly. So, look, we'll go back to where it all started, in Adelaide, I think, yeah?
The first opera I was ever offered, and you'll know this, was for the Come Out Festival in Adelaide in a big circus tent. It was an opera that had been on in Lyon and it was called The Labours of Hercules. It involved massive puppets. I remember the Hydra monster operated by 12 puppeteers and opera singers and acrobats. And you were in it.
Yes, I was.
And you played the Mad King.
Yes, King Eurystheus.
Eurystheus. And I have a photo of you in a mad go-kart with a colander as a crown on your head and knives and forks sticking out of it. And I remember you being absolutely wonderful. But it was a circus. It was an event.
Yeah, it was a circus opera.
It was a crazy circus event for children, but really for adults as well.
Yeah.
And that was the first big, large-scale piece of organisation and the coordination.
And it was brilliant. And there were queues of people, I remember, right up King William Street to come and see the show.
And then, you know, I was young and stupid, naive and fearless.
Yeah.
So I didn't even think this is a massive challenge, oh my God, how hideous, because you had to coordinate so many different groups of people. So in those days, you and I were both young and brave and we just jumped in and did those things. And then I was offered in Adelaide the premiere of Sweeney Todd. Andrew Green was running the South Australian Opera Company and invited me to do it. And I teamed up with that wonderful design team, Ken Wilby and Mark Thompson, who I had a long relationship with.
It was a great set. Great set.
And I'd worked with them at the South Australian Theatre Company, and we did the Australian premiere of Sweeney Todd with yours truly playing Sweeney. And I can see you to this day. It was a wonderful performance and a perfect, marriage of performer and role, because it required such kind of courage and daring and darkness, exploration of the darkness. So my first two operas in my life, 30 years ago would it be, or longer?
Yeah. Let's see, 86 I think was Sweeney Todd.
Yep. So it's quite a long time. And both of them involved you.
Well, they were both fantastic productions. And I think from that Sweeney, which was a wonderful production, really extraordinary,
it was.
Then that launched you into doing extraordinary things. So do you want to talk a little bit about, because maybe people don't realise the sort of career that you had in the UK, for example, and still have in the UK with Andrew Lloyd Webber and with Cameron McIntosh and those big musicals, Les Mis, Phantom of the Opera. Do you want to talk a little bit about those?
That
must have been an incredible experience, because those pieces were quite new then.
Oh, look, I have had the most blessed and most extraordinary opportunities in my career. But on the other hand, I've also full-heartedly thrown myself into everything 100% without reservation. So it works both ways, you know. And usually I would, you know, the expression is go to the wall to make something work.
Yeah.
So I was invited to the Royal Shakespeare Company because I knew Trevor Nunn. And Trevor Nunn, of course, had run the Royal Shakespeare Company for 28 years. he'd then done Cats and Les Miserables. Yeah. I did Les Mis on Broadway with him because John Caird, his associate, couldn't come. Mm. And I was well and truly trevved. Mm. There are famous stories about him putting his arm around you and talking quietly. And you fall completely under his spell. Mm. When he came to Australia and did Les Miserables, I was his associate director. Yeah. And then I later directed it in Vienna in German. And Trevor wouldn't go for various reasons. And I remember Trevor saying to me on the phone, yes, you must do it. You stand there in my place and you speak there with my voice.
Mm. Oh, that's fantastic.
And I was the acolyte of Trevor Nunn. And Trevor Nunn is probably still one of the greatest living directors.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he was my mentor in many ways.
Yeah.
And he effortlessly went between opera, Glyndebourne, musicals, Cats, Les Mis, and Shakespeare and modern plays. And so I thought that that was completely normal.
Mm.
There were no models in Australia like that.
Yeah.
And I just met him and thought, oh, well, that's normal.
Mm.
And my career has followed his path in a way because I've done new works, plays.
And the National Theatre too in London?
Yeah. I've worked at the English National Opera, I've worked on the West End, I did George Bernard Shaw's St. Joan on the West End, I've worked four times at the Royal Shakespeare Company, I was the first woman ever to direct at the on the main stage of the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Yeah.
Most women were sort of, women directors tended to direct down the street at a small place called The Other Place.
Mm.
No shame in that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Judy Dench and Ian McKellen did their Macbeth down there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was not no slouch.
Yeah.
But on the big stage for the big statement, I was the first woman in history. And I went back three times, and indeed I did work at the other place. Mm. So I've done plays on the West End, and of course I met Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Mm. Mm.
Because I was doing Aspects of Love here for the Really Useful Group. I'd never met him.
Mm.
And I had a thought that a song should be in a different place.
Mm.
So I rang him in London to have a chat.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, Andrew. I'm directing Aspects, and I just think that the song there would be much better placed. Well, you're an absolute idiot, he said. You have no understanding of what I'm doing. I don't know how you're... I mean, he just went off on the phone, the famous stories of Andrew.
Yeah.
And I was cringing, as you might imagine, and I thought, oh, don't bring this up. Mm. But, of course, he saw the production in Australia and he rang me at midnight and said, you are a genius. Mm. You have seen into the heart of my music, you've understood my music and what I'm trying to do. So we went from you're an incompetent idiot to you're a genius who's understood everything. And I met Andrew after all of this.
Mm.
And of course, I then worked with him for 20 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
I originated new productions like Whistle Down the Wind, which we did workshops of that are, you know, sort of famous in his mansion in Sidmonton where he has a church hall and they put on productions and test them, and Martin Sheen was flown out from America to be the narrator.
Oh, gee.
I mean, you know, it was an extraordinary lifestyle.
Mm.
And we did many things together, including a revitalization of Jesus Christ Superstar. Andrew had me to dinner one night and he showed me the Holbein painting of Jesus on a slab, Holbein or Hogarth, and it's a cadaver, almost white and pale and green, and he's just lying there like a thing.
Mm.
It's very disturbing. And Andrew said, look at this picture. This is what I think Superstar can and should now be.
Mm-hmm.
In the new world.
Yeah.
In other words, I want a deep exploration. I don't want the fringed shirts and the go-go dancing. Mm. I want a real dark exploration of this. And I thought, well, I'm your girl.
Yeah.
So off I went. And of course, that collaboration went on for years.
Yeah.
That production went you know, to Europe, to Broadway. It played for years on the West End, as did a brand new show he'd written called Whistle Down the Wind. Mm. And he was a great friend and mentor to me, collaborator.
Mm. Do you want to talk a little bit about, because you touched on it then, the depth that you find in your productions? And we have some wonderful productions here in repertoire of yours, La Boheme, The Zalame was so fantastic, Opera on the Harbour, you know, you find something in these productions that firstly inspires the performers to an incredible level, and I can speak from personal experience about that, but you also find that darkness and that depth. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you find that? Because it gives the pieces really another dimension.
Well, of course, I come to opera from the literature of plays.
Yeah.
So I'm a fantastic detective in terms of meaning of lyrics. Mm. And I do a lot of research about the writer's intentions, the composer's intentions. But in opera, you can't work from the lyrics because that's not enough.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a play.
Yeah.
You've got to work from the music and the lyrics and working together. I spend a lot of time examining the work, and I ask the question, what does this piece of theatre mean to, whether it's opera or a play or a musical, what does it mean to this audience in this country at this moment in time?
Yeah.
What is it about?
Yeah.
And I combine that with the original intentions of the composer. And so each show becomes, if you like, a journey down the rabbit hole. I go in for total immersion.
Yeah.
You know, I go down the rabbit hole into Wonderland.
Yeah.
And I explore. I think I'm probably very detailed as a director.
Yeah.
It's ironical because I'm known for the big statement, the big spectacles. But people forget that I've done little tiny plays.
Yeah.
You know, I just did a play last year in the old Fitz, Crap's Last Tape, with Jonathan Biggins that had 60 people in the audience.
Mm.
And it was extraordinary, you know, but I'm known for the big picture.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I spend a lot of time thinking about it. And then when I get the opera singers in the room, well before that, when I work with a designer, because the designer is your married artistic partner.
Yeah, yeah.
And together you come up with a design interpretation.
Mm.
I mean, usually I go into a design meeting with strong ideas.
Yeah.
Like with La Boheme.
Yeah.
I thought, oh my God, how do I cast off the shadow of Baz's extraordinary production?
Mm.
And so I moved it 100 years to a world teetering on the edge of extinction, as Paris was at the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, where artists were coming from all around the world. Mm. It was a breeding hotbed for writers, poets, painters. Mm. So I transferred it to that era and I studied that era. And then I, you know, with Brian Thompson, we invented a set that reflected that. And then you've got to sell it to the singers on the first day. And I showed them films of the Weimar Republic.
Mm.
I showed them black and white films of what really historically happened.
Yeah.
I mean, it was an extraordinary time.
Oh, absolutely.
And those cabarets were bright and brilliant and gorgeous. But the truth was, when the lights were off, that was a society that were poor, largely debauched because they were doing anything to make money.
Yeah.
People were opening their houses and saying, you know, would you like my daughter? It was a very lascivious society with this veneer of fun and spectacle and cabaret over the top. So it was perfect.
Mm.
But that takes exploration and thought.
Yeah.
So I spend a lot of time really thinking about what I do.
Mm.
And then trying to galvanise and take everybody with me on the journey.
Mm.
And I've never met an opera singer yet that didn't get excited on the first day.
Yeah. Is that what's when you do a Shakespearean play? And as you say, you've worked with the Royal Shakespeare Company on a number of occasions. Do you approach that differently than you do an opera or a musical, for example?
Well, that's such an interesting question. I think the reason why I love opera so much is that I love Shakespeare.
Mm.
And I think I'm probably the only director in Australia who's done 16 of the 39 plays. Mm. I used to say that I would direct all 39 before I died, but I think that's probably not going to happen.
You never know.
But I've done them all around the world. I've done a lot in America.
Yeah.
And a lot at the Royal Shakespeare Company. And I did do a lot here, but I think it's been about 18, 19 years since I directed Shakespeare in Australia. Mm-hmm. What does Shakespeare and opera have in common? Well, they deal with large themes, vaulting ambition, passion, desire, betrayal. You know, they deal with such big subjects on such a human and yet epic scale.
Yeah.
And in that sense, they're very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And the text of a Shakespeare play, which is in iambic pentameter, has the same discipline as music on the page.
Mm.
So you can't naturalize iambic pentameter. Mm-hmm. It's da 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 da, just like dots on a score.
Yeah.
So there is this underlying discipline, which I have to say I love, because you are strapped into this thing. You owe it to the composer. And you owe it to Shakespeare to be absolutely faithful to their rhythm.
Yeah.
And where they put a strong stress or where they've elongated a note.
Mm-hmm.
So I spend a lot of time with Shakespeare examining the text and thinking, why is there a feminine ending at the end of that line? Why has he gone from prose to verse? Why has he put the strong stress there? And that's how you study music.
Yeah.
You study music and lyrics in the same way. So I find they're very similar, and I have to say I probably approach them both exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, on the first day of an opera, I usually sit down with the opera singers and say, you know, they've had their music day the day before with the conductor, and I usually say, OK, open your scores. Now let's speak through the whole thing.
Mm.
And this is novel, you know. And I only do it for a morning, you know, I don't waste time. But I mean, I say, let's sit down and do this. And they read it. And if they're reading it in Italian, I ask them to paraphrase it in English. And I've had opera singers who've sung a role 10 times around the world in the greatest houses who have said, oh, my God, I didn't realise I was saying that.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, God, I'm actually saying, because they've never been challenged to think about it.
Yeah.
Because it's all about the sound, the sound, the sound.
Yeah, and many of them don't speak the language.
Many of them, yes, so they've learned it by rote.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I'll spend half a day or three quarters of a day on the first day doing that.
Yeah.
And that kind of alerts everyone in the room that this is going to be a different kind of process.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not just going to be, stand there, darling, you look gorgeous, the light's there, move over there. And you sound marvellous.
Mm.
It's going to be, what is the character crying out through this music?
Mm.
Or celebrating the love through this music in this way?
Yeah.
And so the rehearsal process is very much about dissecting things and not just kind of the overall picture.
Mm.
And it's always been a very positive place.
Mm.
The rehearsal room, pretty much without exception, I can say, has been a place where everyone has felt industrious, allowed to fail, because I have to fail sometimes.
Mm.
I mean, I have to sometimes be allowed to say, I don't know about that.
Mm.
What if you... And the great thing about directing is that no matter how much you prepare... And I prepare really thoroughly.
Mm.
When you get in the room, a singer suddenly does something.
Yeah.
Or an actor does something. And I can think of many instances where you've done things. And as a director, you're amazed.
Mm.
You suddenly go, oh, that's a much better idea than what I'm saying. We'll do it that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have to be open to the artist's individual contribution.
Yeah. Yeah.
To, you know. And... And what they bring to it, you can't just, they're not just automatons or puppets to be moved around.
Yeah,
you know, because then the performance will be hollow at the end.
Yeah. But how with musicals, because it's obviously very similar to opera, but it is slightly different in that usually the performers tend to be more schooled in acting than opera singers,
yes,
and maybe less schooled in singing. But so it is a different sort of performance. So how do you approach that?
Well, musicals, of course, are like operas, but they move faster.
Yeah.
The momentum of a musical is 10 times that of an opera.
Mm.
Operas are slower, great juggernauts that unfold. Yeah. Generally.
Yeah.
Not always, but generally. Musicals are fast. They're fast. They're episodic. And they move quickly.
Yeah.
So that's one problem that you've got to face as a director. Yes, musical performers often are actors who can sing, and that's an advantage. Sometimes they're bad actors who can sing. I mean, you have challenges with performers to get the best out of them in every genre and not to frighten them or offend them, but always to encourage them and to get them to own the work, whether it's a musical or not. I guess you're a little bit more on fast forward in a musical if you've got Philip Quast playing Javert.
Yeah.
And, you know, I saw him on your conversations the other day. Well, Philip Quast is a genius actor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so if you're in the room with Philip, you are in heaven.
Yeah, yeah.
In a musical, you just know you can suggest things and he'll take it somewhere.
Yeah. As I said to him, I remember seeing him do Les Mis, and I think you directed him.
Mm.
And he didn't do much at all.
No.
But you always watched him.
Yes.
That was extraordinary.
Well, the wonderful thing about Philip Quast and Javert, when Trevor came out to direct the production, Philip was straining at the bit, you know, to do Javert.
Mm.
And Trevor Nunn kept saying, go outside, Philip, go outside in the corridor. Go home, it's early, go home. And Philip was like a tiger, you know, because he's so full of, he has so many resources.
Yeah.
And at that time, when he was young, he was prepared to explore the psychotic, you know, he was... And he'd be pacing up and down. And if I went outside, he'd say, Gail, why doesn't he want me in the room? Why doesn't he want me? Well, of course, Trevor's tactic was to not let Philip do anything.
Mm.
And then when he came into the room, to say, don't move.
Yeah.
Don't move your arm. Don't move your hand. Don't move your head.
Mm.
So all this pent-up rage and anger and frustration and wild, and vulnerability came into the room and got channeled into that policeman.
Yeah.
You know, he's zipped up in that uniform with the polished buttons.
Mm.
And Trevor was very cunning. Now, that's cunning directing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because he stopped Philip from doing anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Philip might have wound himself up into all sorts of ideas.
Sure,
that Trevor wasn't interested in.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Well, it was an incredible effect. I mean...
Absolutely extraordinary. Well, Trevor says to this day that Philip was the greatest... Javert the world has ever seen. And I think that's true.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So what about, you've done some film as well. So do you want to talk a little bit about that and about that process?
I loved doing film. I did a show for the ABC years ago, which was part of the Seven Deadly Sins.
Yeah, I remember it, yeah.
Series, and I did one of them. And I later directed a feature film, which was a disaster.
Mm.
I put an end to that career.
Well, it seems to me that, you know, you're... And look, this is... it's interesting to talk about this because you're such a theatrical director.
Yes.
Such a live director that, you know, your place is being in the theatre and seeing things on this stage and it lights up the stage. It's a very different process when you're looking it through through a camera.
It is. The film that I directed was a sort of larger-than-life magical realism piece, though. It wasn't a sort of dark psychological piece, which I kind of wish it had been in a way. I loved directing for film and TV. I loved every minute of it. But it seems that, you know, destiny wasn't going to allow me to go through that door. But what's interesting is that when I was 9, I went to live with my grandmother through tragic circumstances.
Yeah.
And she was an usherette at Hoyt's Cinemas.
Oh, really?
And I was very clever at school. And, you know, I came ducks of the school. And, and so I was really good at homework and study. I was a quiet, shy, studious kid who did very well at school. I don't know how, because I went to the cinema, Hoyt's Cinema, on the bus almost every night of the week.
Really?
Because you didn't have babysitters in 1964. So from the age of 9 to 18, I really spent my life in the cinema. And she'd deposit me there, and I'd have my fantails, you know, which I'd read all about all the stars.
Yes.
And I mean, I saw Elizabeth Taylor in Cleopatra 36 times. I saw Zorba the Greek. You know, we're talking about that era.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would sit there absolutely mesmerised, never bored, never rolled my Jaffas down the aisle. And after I'd seen it three or four times, I knew the centre story. So then I unconsciously, as a kid, I started looking around the edge at what everything else was. And I swear to God, I mean, you talk about, you know, the movie Cinema Paradiso, about the little boy that grows up in the cinema. I grew up in the cinema. They were my I had no friends. I was living with an old lady in a big house, like Great Expectations, Miss Havisham, faded luxury. We were not wealthy. But every day I was seeing this larger-than-life world of heroes and heroines and ideas and learning and absorbing what I was seeing. And it's only now that I reflect what a huge influence that must have been on me. Because when I graduated high school, I had the marks to go to law school or medical school, and my teachers were saying, well, of course, that's what you've got to do. You know, you're a prodigy, you know. And I said, oh, no, I'm going to Flinders University to study drama.
Yeah.
Shock, horror. Because that was that world of fantasy and illusion and gripping storytelling was the world I inhabited as a child.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a long way from being that kid in Adelaide to everything that you've done all over the world. So congratulations, and it's been a real joy to have you today.
Thank you.
And thank you for sharing so many of your experiences with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Great. Thank you for listening to In Conversation with Lyndon Terracini. We hope you've enjoyed the chat, and we'd love for you to subscribe to the podcast. That way, you'll get each new episode as they're released. We also hope to see you in the theatre in the not-too-distant future. And you can stay up to date with all we've got going on at opera.org.au.